Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 48 of season 7 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Sean German of the next scene up. Sean German of the next theme pod. Welcome back to the show, Sean.
You may begin. Yes, welcome. Thank you. Glad to be back. Glad to be on the show.
Yeah. So minute 48 begins with the cops scurrying like rats and ends with police cars leaving the station or leaving the motor pool. So yesterday we ended things with Cobb giving out instructions to all of the police officers that are around, including Chief Allen, who, you know, used to work for the president. And they basically say, come on, guys, let's go. And everyone starts scurrying around and leaving there. And they give us a great shot of there's an overhead shot of all the cops moving around. And during the course of the first few seconds of this minute, the shot gives us a panoramic view of all the different cars that are down, you know, on the street. Mm-hmm. Were you able to count how many police cars there were?
I did not count, but there are a lot.
Okay. There are 18 police cars that we see. 18 blue and whites. You know, there are unmarked cars that are there also. And we have a few fire trucks and ambulances and stuff like that. But I just wanted to count the police cars. And it started getting me, you know, to think about the fact that you know, most police cars, you always think of them, you know, the slang term is a black and white and stuff like that. And so, like, you know, the New York fleet is known for being blue and white instead of black and white, that type of thing. So the entire vehicle fleet of the New York City Police Department, as of the recent count here from 2023, is they have 9,624 police cars, 11 boats, 8 helicopters and a whole bunch of other vehicles that they don't mention anything about here. The colors are blue with are white with two blue stripes along the side, and that they have the word police printed on the front wheel wells. On the grill, it says NYPD Police. They have the NYPD patch on both sides, right near the front doors. And you have NYPD printed on the doors themselves. And then you also have the motto of the NYPD. Do you know what the motto is by any chance?
I don't think it's to serve and protect.
No.
Because that's LA police, right?
That's right.
There's that.
It's CPR, courtesy, professionalism, and respect.
CPR.
That's right.
I should have remembered. It's got the handy acronym there, or right. Abbreviation, initialism.
Right.
That's an interesting bit of trivia. I would not have guessed that there's more. They have more boats, 9, than helicopters, 8.
Oh, sorry, 8. 11 boats. 11 boats and 8 helicopters.
Oh, 11 boats. Oh, 11 boats.
Yeah.
So even more boats than helicopters.
Oh. Well, I guess they have to, you know, patrol the Hudson River and all that stuff. So
yeah.
You know, it sort of makes
Hudson, all the rivers. Sure, it's an island. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Good to know.
Yeah. So I just thought it's very cool that you know, and I mean, I even found a place that has pictures of every single type of car that they use. They have mostly Chevy Impalas, and then you have the. Mm-hmm. Those are patrol vehicles, and then you have the Chevy Volt for traffic enforcement, and the Dodge Charger for traffic enforcement and highway patrol. And, you know, and just it goes through the whole list here. So it's just they even use Teslas.
There you go, there you go. They're getting on electric. So yeah, we see there's some. There's you counted up. You mentioned the blue and whites, and we see some other. I don't know, they're unmarked cars or maybe they're command vehicles. We see other, you know, other vehicles other than.
Well, one of them must be one of them must be Chief Allen's, Allen's car.
Yeah. So. Well, then some of the kind of some of the, like, I guess the quote unquote unmarked cars have, we can see there's a red light on top. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know if that means fire, because usually I think of.
No, the red light. You see those in movies all the time where, you know, they just put a, you know, yeah. What's it called? A bubble light, I think it's called.
Like, yeah, the bubble light on a suction cup or magnet or however. Yeah, they stick it on the roof. So, yeah.
Which always reminds me of the Naked Gun. I'm pretty sure it's the first movie, or maybe it's even just in the TV show it's the first movie, I believe, where basically we are the police car and it takes us to all these different places and you see the revolving, you know, red light right in front of you the whole time. And it ends up going.
Right.
And then like it shows up in the, you know, the maternity ward, you know, coming out of a woman, you know, you know, we see like the face of the doctor, shot. The point of view shot and all that stuff. But in most like 70s detective movies, probably like Kojak and all those type of things, you know, they would just put the bubble light on top, you know, when they needed to go through traffic to get to wherever it is they needed to get to.
Yes.
So yeah, it's just great. And then the shot changes a little bit, and you know, we hear commotion. We hear people saying, move it out, no radio contact. And then the shot reveals that we see Simon, you know, played by Jeremy Irons, watching all the actions down below through binoculars.
I like this kind of the justification for that angle of why we've cut to this overhead shot. It's because we're now seeing it from Simon's angle. As it pans up to show him with the binoculars on the roof of the building. So I like that the tie-in, like everything has got kind of a purpose or a reason.
Yeah, I mean, John McTiernan does that a lot, you know, and there are a lot of other directors that also do this, that, you know, they tell part of the story through the visual aspects of where you're going to even place a camera. You know, this is a perfect example of that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we finally get to see... you know, what Simon looks like. This is the first time we see him in the movie. I mean, think about it. We've gone through 47 minutes of this movie just hearing his voice. And we finally get to see the way that he looks.
Right. And we saw those, the FBI had those pictures, like kind of grainy, hard to make out.
But and he was wearing, he was wearing a Nazi uniform anyway. So it's a little different. You know?
Yeah. So yeah, but, yeah. Over 47 minutes into the film. And we were getting our first look at our antagonist, at the villain, right. The bad mm-hmm. guy.
Yeah. So he looks at somebody, we don't really know who it is, and he smiles as he's talking, and he goes, "They bought it. You can begin." At this point, they go back, and we see a whole bunch of like reporters on the ground, and we see the police cars and the fire engines and you know, trying to you know, around them and stuff like that. You know, everything's moving around and stuff like that. And then we're back and we see another shot of Simon, and we see that he's actually talking to Matthias, who's in the background. And then he looks at Matthias and goes, "Hook, line, and sinker." As he says sinker, we can see in the background that there are dump trucks that are starting to you know, stroll down the road as he does that, which is really, really great.
Yeah, we see a line of at least five. Don't know, there may be more coming around the corner. But, yeah, we see those trucks starting to fill in. Obviously part of Simon's plan as he smiles down on them.
Correct, which is a throwback to something that we talked about during the first or second week of the movie, where they talked about the fact that there were 14 dump trucks that were stolen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that seems like a throwaway line, but I guess it's, you know, Pavlov's stolen dump truck.
Chekhov's dump truck.
Chekhov, not Pavlov. Yeah. Right. We talked about Pavlov last week with Ring a Bell. That's right. Chekhov.
Right. Yeah. Well, and the score as well kind of takes an ominous turn.
Yeah.
You know, the tone, just to let us know, in case we haven't figured out that this is part of the plan, and this is not, you know, these are not this is not the cavalry coming in to save the day. This is not good for McClane or the police, whatever is going on here. So,
correct. Yeah. And for anyone who's familiar with the score of the movie, so they basically start parts of the score. the Johnny Comes Marching On score, but it's done very subtly at this point. It doesn't come full tempo yet.
Right.
You know, it's like a lower tone of the way that they do it.
Mm-hmm.
So do you know what the term hook, line, and sinker means?
I mean, I know what it means. It means kind of like you basically, you know, you fell for something. You were suckered in, you fell for the gag, you took the bait. And it's, an allusion, I guess. I assume it's an allusion. I don't know the origin, but assuming allusion to fishing, you know, if the fish takes the bait and bites the hook and now is caught, that's hook, line, and sinker. Although the fish usually, you know, takes the hook at the end of the line. I don't know where the sinker comes into it.
No, it's because they see everything there. You know, I think mm-hmm. that's the idea. They don't, when a fish does it, they don't see the hook.
Right. They don't see it.
You know, so yes, you are correct. The official definition of the phrase is to be completely fooled by a deception. And it obviously deals with the analogy with a well-hooked fish. And the mm-hmm. first known use of it was in 1838. Beforehand, I guess people just didn't fish as much, or they weren't being as deceptive, I guess. Who mm-hmm. knows? You know, the shot changes again. And we see a whole bunch of cops. So there's a lot of commotion, and they're loading them up into a bus. And we can see on the bus that it says the Port Authority.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are you familiar with the Port Authority?
Yeah. Well, there's not as a whole, there is a Port Authority bus station. Usually if you just say Port Authority, that's the main bus station, I think around 42nd Street in Manhattan. I've ridden in and out of that a few times, and also just driving into Manhattan, use the attached parking. So it's actually not too far from Broadway and Times Square. And if you're going to see like a Broadway play or something in Manhattan, it's a convenient place to park. It's sort of like near the river. It's kind of like it's not outside of the city, but it's easy to get to if you just want to park there and then, you know, do your walking is much easier than driving to get around sort of the inner blocks of the city. So I've parked at the Port Authority bus terminal a few times, but not really familiar with the Port Authority as an agency.
Okay,
other than that, I'm guessing they have their own, you know, their own transit police that would yes. be aiding in this effort.
That they do too. Right. So it was established in 1921. So it's been around for 103 years as of now.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically are in, it's a venture that was created between New York and New Jersey as an mm-hmm. interstate compact authorized by Congress, that basically what they can do is they deal with all the regional transportation infrastructure, dealing with bridges, tunnels, airports, and seaports. And basically it's a 1500 square mile area. It's known mm-hmm. as a port district.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes within a 25 mile radius of the Statue of Liberty. And their headquarters are in the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And basically they deal with any type of shipping, and they deal with, you know, crossing over between the various boroughs in New York. You know, so anytime you got to pay like 15 or 16 bucks to get across one of the bridges, you know, that all that money is going to the Port Authority, you know, to help pay for whatever they wanted to.
Yeah.
I mean, basically when it started in 1921, they had problems right after everyone went off to war during World War I and everything like that. They realized that there was too much congestion at the port, and they realized that they needed some organization to be there to supervise the complex system that is all around there, which includes, again, the bridges and highways and subways and the various port facilities and stuff like that. So basically both the governors of New York and New Jersey decided, hey, why don't we just do this together? And the idea was is that it became independent of either state, and therefore mm-hmm. it doesn't get its funding from taxes. You know, where does its funding come from? Everyone who crosses tolls. That's yeah. right, all the tolls.
You cross a bridge or a tunnel, and you got to get into New York, and yeah, it's a lot of money these days.
Yeah,
There's a lot of ports. It makes sense.
Yeah. So I mean, they've changed the name over the years, but now it's known as the it's officially known as the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which tries to show you know the cooperation between the two states when dealing with this. Mm-hmm. You know, and over the years, different bridges and tunnels and stuff like that slowly became part of it. You know, like when the George Washington Bridge was built in 1927, so. You know, that was already linking between Manhattan and New Jersey. So, you know, it was good that they had the Port Authority to already be dealing with this type of stuff.
Right. So it'd be natural fit. You have the agency ready to administer such things.
Correct. And then when the Holland Tunnel came around and the Lincoln Tunnel, you know, the whole way that they did this, it was all via the Port Authority and therefore they decided that the best way to do it is also to fund it via everyone paying, the tolls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the, you know, a bridge or tunnel not necessarily, fits the strict definition of a port, like an airport or a seaport. But, you've got, multiple jurisdictions involved, one on each end. So, if you've got this kind of interstate or super state agency that can administer that thing, go for it.
Yeah. So there's been a lot of issues over the years about it, but one of the main issues was that after the original World Trade Center bombing in 1993, the survivors and the families sued the Port Authority because they basically said that they were negligent in not making security upgrades that could have prevented the attack.
Interesting.
Yeah, the court ruled that they were actually negligent, which is even crazier. How come a few years later, when it happened, again, they didn't sue them from that perspective.
I can see the attacks in 2001. Not sure what the Port Authority could have done. Although on the other end, sort of the security for the planes, I think a couple of the planes, I know there was one plane that took off. There's also there was one plane that took off from Boston.
No, there were two, one of the planes. Two that took off, if I remember correctly, two took off from Boston, one from Newark Boston. And one from DC.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So right. I think like the one in Newark would have been in terms of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey and security. But certainly on the building end, I don't know what you can do unless you have like anti-aircraft guns. Like how do you stop a plane from hitting a building?
That's right. Yeah. So they at the time of 9/11, they had 1,400 Port Authority employees that were working in the World Trade Center itself. And miraculously, only 84 lost their lives. Out of 1,400, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
37 of them were police officers. The executive director of the Port Authority was also killed, as well as the Port Authority police superintendent for the whole thing. So yeah, it's there's a lot of information about the Port Authority. At this point, we're back and we see a shot of a whole bunch of cops in a leaving like a motor pool.
Mm-hmm.
And as they're coming out, each of them hand their radios over to someone who's standing at the exit as they're going through. And we hear, "All right, now, men, let's go, let's go." And then we hear another, "Let's go," as things are moving along and stuff like that. Now, my question is, okay, they're taking their radios. I can understand that. But they're taking their hand radios. Like you have a walkie. It looks like they're taking walkie-talkies, basically, right?
Right.
But what about the radios in the car itself? They should have like a dispatch radio or something like that in the car.
Yeah.
So it's if they're taking this extra precaution of taking out all of the radios, okay, I can understand that. No problem with it. But what about the ones that are in the cars?
I guess it would take too long to pull those out. I mean,
because no, like, but it's like, I don't trust you. I don't trust you to accidentally turn on your walkie-talkie, but mm-hmm. it's fine if you drive around in your police car and turn on your radio.
Well, and maybe it is because, I mean, I kind of thought the same thing. They're taking the radios just because force of habit. They'd forget, oh, you're not supposed to use radios. Maybe the car radio is okay because, you know, they're presuming based on what they've told by Simon that the bomb and the, you know, the associated radio detonator is inside one of the buildings. So if they're walking through and searching and they, you know, mistakenly make a call on their portable radio, you know, their walkie-talkie, that may set off the detonator and therefore the bomb. Whereas if they're calling from their car on the street, that's less of a danger because they're not
okay.
You know, they're not going to be in the building with the car.
I can buy that. Other except for the fact that we don't know the ring. You know, without knowing the ring. Yeah, but yeah. Okay, that's hook, line, and sinker. You got me on that one. There you go.
There you go. That's my story. I'm sticking to it.
You do that. You do that.
But yeah. So yeah, we see them. Yeah, you know, collecting the walkie talkies as the car pulls out, and then we see there's a couple. We see a couple shots of. Officers on cell phones.
Yeah.
And for kids, this is what cell phones looked like in the mid 90s. So, you know, in case someone doesn't recognize, what are those things they're talking into? That's what cell phones used to look like.
These large bulky things.
Yes. Yeah. With antennas that stick out of them.
Yes. I remember you had to close the antenna when you were done.
Yeah, my first cell phone had a little the antenna would extend, and then you could push it back in when you were not calling anyone.
Exactly. All right, and that's all I have for this minute. Do you have anything else for this minute?
Yeah, that pretty much it. Just you know, kind of reiterate something we talked about earlier in the week, how you know, in true diehard fashion, that the you know, the bad guys, the villains, have the police playbook. So the police are springing into action, and yet this is all going according to the, you know, the evil plans and the, you know, our bad guy Simon here is, you know, is not disturbed or upset. In fact, he's actually pleased by the reaction that he's getting from the police.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And we'll see later in the week. We'll see later in the week he gets even happier.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
All right. Excellent.
Yeah, so that's all I got for 48.
All right. So let's go to the script. So it starts off the rooftop on Wall Street. We are on a rooftop 25 stories above the blast site. Below on Wall Street, the cops are scurrying off to try and find the bomb in the school. A man is on the edge of the roof looking down. He turns away and we are face to face with Simon Gruber, age 42. Everything about this man is discerning. His physicality, the way he moves, the way he lights a cigarette. His eyes are very blue, yet dead like a shark. His smile is ironic, detached. Simon then says, "They bought it." Matthias Targo, next to Simon, nods. Targo is Hungarian, 30s, compact and deadly. He never smiles. Simon flips open a cellular phone, punches some numbers. Go. Simon and Targo turn and look north, up Greenwich Avenue towards Tribeca. A mile away, they can see 10 huge industrial dump trucks wheel around a corner and head down Greenwich Avenue towards Wall Street. Simon pocks the cellular phone and turns to Targo, who wears a grim inspection. Simon then says, "Did someone die?" Simon smiles. Targo maintains his grim expression. "We got on the train, Simon." "He got on the train, Simon. The bomb detonated in the wrong place." "It's close enough. You have more in common with your brother than I thought." "What? You both underestimate this man." Simon's smile vanishes. He is instantly cold, detached. "Keep your opinions about my brother and me to yourself, Matthias." Simon turns and walks off. Targo watches him. Kennedy Airport. An NYPD airport security captain hangs up a phone and turns to a sergeant. "Release every man you can spare and get over to the Manhattan Bureau. They've got a situation over there, and don't lose your radios." The sergeant hurries off. Tri-Barrel Authority during the day in New York. NYPD bridge and tunnel captain screams at his subordinates, who hustle for the door. "Move, people, move!" Midtown Bureau, detectives' bullpen, an emergency briefing. The room is filled with uniformed cops and detectives, some still entering. Cobb is in the front of the room with a huge map of New York, breaking down assignments. The motor pool of the NYPD, a police motor pool garage, a line of 100 NYPD cruisers. As each cruiser exits the garage, the cop at the wheel hands a CB policeman radio to a cop collecting them. So it's very descriptive. You know, they do jump around a little bit, show us more things that are going on around the city. But I think most of it is just unnecessary. I do like the extended conversation between Simon and Targo, because it shows that Targo sees the danger of John and Simon doesn't.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and there's no way in the movie where they bring up something like this. So it's it's somewhat disappointing that they missed this one. But oh well. What can you think? It's the way these things work. All right. So every Wednesday we have a segment called Jesus Hump Day, where my guests will give their top five Samuel L. Jackson performances. So, Don, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
All right. Start with my number five and work my way up. So, and this is tough because there's been so many Sam Jackson performances. But a lot of them, there's a lot of like movies that are among my favorites, things like Goodfellas, where it's a very small part. So that's not. That's not on my list. I mean, it's a great performance, but it's such a small part that Sam Jackson has in that film. So, but to go with my top five Sam Jackson performances, I'm going to go with number five is Shaft from 2000, which is not a great film, but I like his performance. We get a good performance from Sam Jackson as the titular Shaft in that remake from 2000. For number four, I'm going to go with actually this film, Die Hard with a Vengeance. I think that's going to be my number four Sam Jackson performance. Number three, we've got The Incredibles, which is great voiceover work. We don't see Sam Jackson, but we certainly hear a lot of him. So enjoyed his work with The Incredibles. For number two, I'm going to go with The Long Kiss Goodnight. From 1996.
Nah, 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 nah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then my number one Sam Jackson performance is Pulp Fiction. And I know some people might go Jackie Brown for Sam Jackson or Quentin Tarantino. For whatever reason, Jackie Brown, like I enjoy it, it's good, but it didn't hit me quite the same way that Pulp Fiction did. So that's going to be my number one choice there for Sam Jackson films.
All right. That is a great list. Thank you very much for that. All right. So, Sean, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Sean German?
Yeah. Once again, if you want to hear me talking about stuff, I talk about stuff on a couple places. So I've got my nextscenepod.com for the Next Scene podcast, where we talk about all things pop culture, one scene at a time. And then coming up later in 2024, Casablanca Minute, where we cover the Warner Brothers classic, 1 minute at a time, much like Movie Rob is doing here with Die Hard and other films. We're going to do that to Casablanca. So, yeah, check that out.
All right. Excellent. Looking forward to that. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can find me on Facebook. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send an email to movierobminute@movierob.net. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
Johnny comes marching home again, hurrah, hurrah! We'll give him a hearty welcome then, hurrah, hurrah! The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies, they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.